Hello, full-bodied family. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Full-Bodied Crime Podcast. As always, my name is Kayla, and I'm so excited to be back with you guys. I'm sorry for the delay in episodes, but in my heart, it truly hasn't felt like the right time to put out an episode. I had to take a lot of personal time to understand everything happening in the world, digest it, process it, and plus I moved across the country, so I finally moved from California to Kentucky, and I'm all settled in. I'm in a nursing program as we speak, but as of right now, I'm able to get episodes out to you guys, and I chose this specific program because I get my bachelor's degree in just 12 months. I think a regular BSN program is around 2 to 3 years, so it's a lot of information in one sitting, but I'm going to try and do my best to get out episodes to you guys every week, and I'm going to shoot for Sundays as my release day every week, and I'll let you know ahead of time if I'm unable to complete the next Sunday, so be listening out for that. But enough about me, let's give you guys what you came here for and get into today's crime. The main source of information for this episode is from the ID Channel show On the Case with Paula Zahn, specifically season 20, episode 8, titled The Long Walk, Cold Night. So today we'll be discussing the murder of Tracy Lynn Hammerberg. This was a murder with more twists and turns than I can even count, and it went unsolved for decades until 2019, when the killer was finally caught through one of the greatest DNA advancements, forensic genealogy. Tracy Lynn Hammerberg was a fun-loving girl who was just out of high school when she met her untimely demise at just the age of 18 years old. To provide a little background on the victim, she was born on March 7, 1966, to mother Judy and father Harlan Hammerberg. She was born in Milwaukee, and she spent the first half of her life there before moving to Saukville, Wisconsin in 1976. Now, even though there's only about a 26-ish mile difference between Saukville and Milwaukee, there are still large differences between the two areas. Saukville is very small. It's a rural Wisconsin town, and the population, even in 2018, hadn't surpassed 5,000. But once moving to Saukville and adjusting from the numerous differences between Milwaukee and there, Tracy made many friends, attended Port Washington High School, and quickly grew into a woman who was ready to take on the world. However, little did anyone know that there was a different ending and tragic ending to the book of Tracy Hammerberg. On December 15th, 1984, I can imagine this being a happy time in Wisconsin. Snow is on the ground, the air is crisp, and you're preparing for Christmas, which is only a few short days away. But this December 15th was not going to be like any other morning. Specifically for a man who woke up and decided to go check on his property after the sun had risen. His property was located in nearby Grafton, which, per Google Maps, sits about 5 miles outside of Saukville. But this morning was not like his routine property checks. There was something there, something different. The man approached this item that had never previously been on his property, and that's when he stumbled upon the gruesome scene of a bludgeoned woman. In an absolute panic, he called the Ahwatukee sheriffs, who reported to the scene, and I don't think anyone could have prepared them for what they were about to see. Around 6:27 a.m., lying atop of 2 inches of snow, was the bloodied, beaten body of a female who was naked from the waist down. Investigators were in shock by the level of violence that had taken place leading up to this woman's death. An investigator even described the appearance of her body as, quote, her green sweater was pulled above her breast, her jeans were cast over her, and her shoes, they were soaked in blood. Now, Ahwatukee County is relatively safe. Things like this don't happen here frequently, especially back in the 1980s. After digesting the scene and analyzing the body, there were two theories that investigators had in mind. One, that this was a sexually motivated crime, and two, that she knew or was familiar with her killer. Lucky for investigators, there were some significant clues left at this scene. There was blood present in the surrounding trees, which indicated that this was the exact site where the murder occurred, versus just being a dumping ground. There was a pack of cigarettes at the bottom of the victim's feet, indicating that her killer was a smoker. And there were tire impressions present in the snow, which essentially is similar to a fingerprint for an automobile. Investigators knew that their top priority was to identify the victim. They came across some obstacles with this because she had no ID on her and there was no recent reports of a missing person in this area that fit the victim's description. The body itself did have some identifiers, being a tattoo on her right wrist, and she had a class ring on her left ring finger. Once investigators saw the ring, they felt confident that the body was not going to remain unidentified for long. The class ring was from Bowdoin High School, with the name Glenn engraved on it. But upon further investigation, they realized there was no Bowdoin High School in the state of Wisconsin, that this high school was actually located in North Dakota, which sits about two states northwest of Wisconsin. This threw a completely new wrench in the investigation because now they weren't sure if the victim was actually from this area or if she was from a completely different state. So detectives were hoping to find more information about the victim and her identity through the autopsy. But what they really found out was just how horrific this crime really was. The victim was not only raped and strangled, but she was also completely bludgeoned to death. The medical examiner presumed that the patient had been beaten with a metallic object that was similar to a tire iron. Now, at this time, investigators still had no idea who their victim was, so the autopsy unfortunately did not help them with this identification process, but there was biological evidence obtained from the presumed killer, and investigators had hoped that this would lead them in the right direction to finding the person who was responsible for committing this horrible crime. Amidst trying to find out who the victim was, the Ahwatukee County Sheriff's Department received a disturbing call. An anxious and distraught mother called the Sheriff's Department and said something along the lines of, "I saw that you guys had found a body on the news, and I think the body that you've been trying to identify is my daughter. Her name is Tracy Lynn Hammerberg, she's 18 years old, and she didn't return home last night after babysitting." She then gave the description of her daughter, 5 feet 2 inches, she weighs 115 pounds. So overall, Tracy was a very petite girl, but investigators finally knew that they had a positive ID when her mother said she had a heart-shaped tattoo on her right wrist and was wearing her boyfriend from North Dakota's class ring on her left ring finger. I couldn't imagine what was going through the minds of like the investigator and Tracy's mom at this time, having to confirm to someone that, yes, their daughter, their life, their reason for being alive, had not only been murdered, but raped, strangled, and beaten to death. It was later discovered that the murder actually only occurred a few miles away from Tracy's home, and something about a life being taken so close to home, for me, it gives me chills. Somewhere you feel safe, somewhere where you call home is just a few miles away, and here you are fighting for your life only to be left in the freezing Wisconsin winter, waiting for your deceased body to be discovered in a few hours by a man whose life is also forever changed, because those aren't just images or situations that you can get out of your head. But Tracy's family was absolutely devastated over this news. Why would someone do this to this young woman who was so caring, would do anything for anyone, and someone who was truly such a light in their lives? Tracy was just months away from moving to North Dakota to be with her boyfriend, and she had so many things to look forward to in the near future. She was planning on getting a job in North Dakota, saving for college, and her sister Lori said she had always dreamed about becoming a veterinarian, and that Tracy had an overwhelming love for animals. So detectives knew that they had to get this sinister killer off the streets, and they'd hoped to do it as quickly as possible to ensure that no other innocent life, especially that of a teenager, would be taken at the hands of this man. Detectives began their investigation by piecing together the evening preceding the discovery of Tracy's body. As her mother mentioned, Tracy was in Saukville the night before babysitting, and she babysat from the hours of 7:30 p.m. to 9:45 p.m., After she was done babysitting, she then went to a local convenience store and met up with two of her guy friends named Matt and Scott. As a group, they went to a local bar, purchased a six-pack of beer, and then drove 5 miles to Matt's home and had a party, or kickback as we called it back in my day, with just the few of them hanging out and playing drinking games. Now, Scott and Matt both have nearly identical stories about meeting up with Tracy and what time they met up, the character of events leading back to Matt's house, and so on and so forth. However, their account does start to differ around the time of midnight when Tracy did leave the party, but we'll get into that in a little bit. So around midnight, Matt's older brother David arrived home, and then all the men like sort of agree that Tracy decided to leave and walk home shortly after David got there. So basically right after midnight. Now this is where the story gets strange. Tracy decided to walk home, which is kind of the first red flag that should be coming to your mind if you're thinking about a Wisconsin winter. It was snowing, it was freezing, the temperature outside, Tracy's house wasn't right down the street or a block away. She lived about 3.7 miles away from Matt's house, so the temperature, distance, and increased risk of danger being that it was past midnight in that time of night. I mean, all those are somewhat suspicious right off the bat, but the three men are persistent that she wanted to walk home. Like, Tracy was adamant that she wanted to walk. Now, David did say that he offered her a ride home, but that she refused his offer. Her body was 5 miles away from Matt's house when they discovered it, so they were very sure that Tracy didn't walk to this location, especially considering that her house was only 3.7 miles away and her body was found 5 miles away. So basically, this is our timeline. Basically, there's 6 hours from the time that Tracy left Matt's house at midnight and from when her body was discovered at 6:27 in the morning. Around where the body was found, detectives then asked neighbors if they saw anything abnormal early that morning or if there was anything suspicious that they could report. One of the neighbors was getting up to go hunting around 5:45, so less than an hour before Tracy's body was discovered, and he reported that a vehicle without its lights on was rapidly accelerating away from the Maple Road crime scene. Even so fast to where his tires squealed, but that's all the information this specific hunter had. A few moments later, another hunter saw a dark sedan-looking vehicle flipping on its headlights as it was speeding out of the area and fleeing the scene. So investigators are now painting this story in their head. Tracy left the party. She was in a vehicle with someone that she knew because her family was adamant that she would not have gotten into a car with a stranger. They believe that whoever she was in the car with tried making a sexual advance towards her, and when she refused, he took her to a secluded area off of this Maple Road, brutally raped her, strangled her, and then ended her life with blows to the right side of her head. Investigators kept trying to process this information, and they just continually felt that like one of these three men at the party, Matt, Scott, or David, had more information than they were telling investigators. To detectives, it just didn't make sense that Tracy would, A, want to walk home with not only the temperature, but all of the other risk factors that are associated with walking home in the middle of the night. They bring the three men into the department for further questioning when they get their next big red flag that something just isn't right. So David, Matt's brother, who returned home from work that night moments before Tracy decided to walk home, begins looking like the investigator's prime suspect. He states that he was driving home from Milwaukee that night when he got a flat tire, changed the tire on the side of the road, and accidentally left his tire iron on the side of the road. Now, if we go back to the autopsy report, the medical examiner believed that Tracy was bludgeoned and beaten with a metallic object that was consistent with a tire iron. So investigators get wide-eyed, and they believe that they're looking at the killer of Tracy Hammerberg. Which, honestly, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, for it to be a coincidence for him to lose his tire iron on the same night that someone he came in contact with was murdered by a suspected tire iron, I mean, that's a pretty large coincidence. So they take a sample of David's blood, and investigators are sure that this blood type is going to match the blood type of Tracy's killer. But they're absolutely shocked when David's blood is not the same as the DNA obtained from the crime scene. Not only did David's blood type not match, but neither did Matt or Scott's. Which, looking back now, since we've had such advancements in DNA, that's so crazy to me that blood typing DNA used to be such a big thing. I mean, in my physiology class, we had to figure out our blood types, and my best friend and I were the same blood type, along with at least a third of the class. So maybe there's more involved with blood typing DNA, but honestly, it just seems very nonspecific, if you will. But I'm sure this DNA put a lot of guilty people away, but I also wonder if it put innocent people away who were incarcerated simply due to being the same blood type as an actual person who committed a crime. But anyway, like I said, maybe there's more that goes into it. I'm honestly not sure if it's a more complex system than I'm assuming, but let's get back to the story. So after this blow, investigators feel like they are back to square one. Their main suspect, even suspects, aren't aligning with the contents taken from the crime scene, and they're seeming pretty stagnant in their investigation. But then one day, a woman calls detectives and blows the case wide open and in a completely different direction. A woman called and said that a man named Dale Schultz, who was a local garage worker, could potentially be responsible for the death of Tracy Hammerberg. The woman basically says that the morning of the murder, so December 15th, 1984, Dale showed up to her house with a bloodstained jacket and that he asked her to wash his jacket. Dale basically described that he had been involved in a bar fight and this is how he got the blood onto the jacket. And this woman was like, okay, this is kind of an odd request. But she ended up washing the jacket without any further questioning. But as the media got wind of the murder and was persistent on trying to find Tracy's killer, this woman did the math and realized that the same morning that Dale had brought her this bloody jacket to be washed was the same morning that Tracy was murdered. So just like the case of David, Matt's brother, misplacing his tire iron the night of the murder, what another suspicious coincidence to occur that Dale has this bloody jacket on the same morning that Tracy was murdered. So to make Dale Schultz seem even more suspicious, he was actually familiar with Tracy. Not only did they know each other, but they had actually dated for a short period of time. Additionally, Schultz had an extensive criminal record, which included violence against women. So now investigators are like, okay, here we go. The victim's criminally familiar, he's an ex-boyfriend, perhaps even a jealous ex-boyfriend. He sees Tracy walking home after midnight, offers her a ride, makes a sexual advance that was rejected, he gets furious, rapes her, strangles her, and beats her to death, leaving the body to be discovered around 6 a.m. that morning. This is all coming together and making total sense to investigators. This is their guy. It has to be their guy. Now, investigators bring Dale Schultz in for questioning and ask him, where were you on December 15th between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m.? This is where Dale's hole gets dug even deeper. He was at a bar in the town of Grafton where he left around 1 a.m., and his route home from the bar would have directly crossed paths with the route Tracy was walking home. And not only that, there was also a huge gap in time from when he left the bar to the time when he dropped off the bloody jacket at his friend's house. So there's a huge gap there that's completely unaccounted for. And investigators even say that he didn't have a good alibi. It also doesn't help that Schultz reported to detectives when asked if he was involved in the case, quote, "If I did do it, I don't remember doing it." But a conviction is not warranted off words, but more so physical evidence. So Dale gives a sample of his blood, and apparently this specific blood type of the murderer is extremely rare, and it's only present in 3% of the male population. So once investigators get the blood type results back, they're absolutely shocked that Dale Schultz is a match to the blood type found at the crime scene. 3% chance and he's a match. So everything is aligning and investigators are sure that they have their murderer. But detectives are once again thrown a huge wrench in their investigation. Prosecutors will not bring the case to trial because they do not feel like the poor alibi, the bloody jacket, and the positive match of a less than 3% blood type is enough evidence to prove that Dale Schultz is the murderer beyond a reasonable doubt. Investigators are absolutely shocked, and honestly, so was I when diving into this story. I mean, everything seems to match up and align perfectly, even down to the DNA evidence. Investigators were absolutely devastated, and they had absolutely no idea where to go from here. Dale Schultz was released from custody and immediately fled to Colorado, which obviously made him look that much more suspicious. And detectives were left wondering if they had just released a murderer back into the general public. Investigators kept looking for clues or witnesses that would either lead them to a new killer or support their case against Dale Schultz, but there was nothing. And for 20 years, the case remained cold. Tracy's family and friends were left wondering who took the life of this precious woman and if they would ever, ever, ever get justice for her. In 2005, their investigation was finally reopened by Jim Johnson, who had actually gone to the same high school as Tracy, and he knew a lot of the same people that Tracy was involved with. Johnson and the other investigators working on the case went back through the case files with a fine-tooth comb. And they knew the answer was in there, and they were determined to find it. First thing was first, reassessing and analyzing the DNA that was found at the crime scene. With the advancements in DNA technology and DNA profiling over the years, they had the killer's DNA and Dale's DNA, and now they could compare the two one-on-one. And the DNA could specifically be linked to Dale versus it just being the same blood type. But for the ultimate twist and turn in this case, the DNA was not a match to Dale, and he was officially ruled out as a suspect in the murder of Tracy Hammerberg. I mean, I was shocked at this point in the investigation because I was even sure that Dale had been the killer. So, the DNA was entered into the CODIS database, and investigators were praying for a match, but there was no hit in the CODIS system. Investigators regroup and they go back to square one. The square one that involved the last place that Tracy was officially seen alive, at Matt's house. Matt and Scott were questioned again and the detective zeroed in on Scott. Scott's story had changed from the initial interview where he had said the night of Tracy's murder that he had left Matt's home, went home, and parked in his garage, and now 20 plus years later, Scott was saying that he had actually left his car in Matt's driveway overnight, and he was also missing a set of keys for the car at that time, so he was unsure if someone drove his car from Matt's house that night. Investigators were very suspicious over this comment and were sure that the car was holding some secrets related to Tracy's death. To investigators' surprise, Scott still had the car that was in question, and he initially refused detectives' efforts to search the car, but after being confronted with a search warrant, he actually asked investigators that if they did find something in the car, could he be offered some type of immunity if he was to be taken to trial. Super suspicious, if you ask me. But at this time, detectives are completely suspicious and anxiously awaiting the results from the crime lab to come in. Crime scene investigators did find blood in the back seat of the car, and detectives are starting to put Scott at the top of their suspect list. To add to their suspicion, the tires of the vehicle had been changed, and the front seats were removed from the car. So all these factors are once again adding up, and not in Scott's favor. However, the results of the blood testing indicated that yes, the blood was in fact from a human, but they were unable to get a full DNA profile from it. This was another huge blow to the investigation, and investigators were just devastated at this point. I mean, they've now been on numerous occasions, had so much evidence leading up to not only one suspect, not only two suspects, but three promising suspects, and they weren't able to seal the deal with any of them. But ultimately, the DNA from the crime scene further eliminated Matt, Scott, David, and Dale from being the killer in Tracy Hammerberg's murder. Investigators were relentless in their efforts, and they were determined to find this murderer. They ended up testing over 400 DNA profiles against the DNA of the killer, and they were still unable to find a match. Detective Heller said that he was not giving up, and he even put Tracy's photo in his notebook as a constant reminder that this girl needed justice. Now, if the investigation hadn't already had blow after blow, investigators were informed that in testing these 400 plus profiles, they had used up all of the killer's DNA, and they now didn't have any source to compare the killer's biological evidence to. They were so upset, but had prayed for a miracle, and basically a miracle was just what they got. The medical examiner who performed the autopsy had stored one vial of the killer's DNA during her autopsy, and this was the last remaining biological evidence of Tracy's killer. So with this new DNA, they decided to take a different route and use the DNA for forensic genealogy testing, which they had only discovered this method of testing because of the recent conviction of the Golden State Killer, and this was literally their last hope in finding Tracy's killer. And sure enough, they had found the family tree where Tracy's killer had descended from. There were obviously numerous people that were in this genealogy test that were brought to light, but investigators now had a more focused source and were ready to bring justice to the killer of Tracy Hammerberg. they were eliminating name after name, suspect after suspect, and then they came across one man that they were continuously unable to eliminate as a suspect from this gene pool. His name was Philip Cross, a name that had never been brought up in the investigation previously. Detectives were suspicious over this man, one, because his DNA was present in the family gene pool, two, because he had worked in Grafton, Wisconsin at the time of the murder, which is where the murder occurred, and three, somehow detectives were able to get his time card from that night, which was over 20 years prior, and they discovered that he got off work at midnight on the morning of the murder. And to top it off even more, the road that he took to get home from work was the exact same road that Tracy would have been walking on to get home. Detectives would also later uncover that at the time of Tracy's murder, when Philip Cross was just 21 years old, he was driving a dark-colored sedan, much like the one described by the hunter when he saw the car fleeing from the crime scene the morning of the murder. I think one of the most disturbing incidences of Philip Cross was that he not only had a troubled past with law enforcement, but there was also an incident where he was offered a ride home by a woman from a bar, and on this drive home, he proceeded to take off his belt and attempted to strangle her. Thank God this woman escaped, but she was sure that if she had not managed to escape, that he would have murdered her. Now, if we rewind a bit, we can remember that Tracy's family was sure that she would never get in the car with a stranger or someone she didn't know. But when the name Philip Cross was brought to the attention of the family, Tracy's brother actually knew him from riding the same bus as him, and Tracy knew him from high school even though they weren't in the same grade. Investigators ultimately conclude this as the final moments of Tracy's life. That she was walking home that freezy early Wisconsin morning from her friend Matt's house when she realized she was cold and probably should have taken a ride from David. She was then approached by Philip Cross, who was a familiar face, and ultimately accepted a ride home from him. Investigators feel that the moment she entered his car, he knew he wanted to have sex with Tracy. When she rejected him, he became furious and enraged, which ultimately led to her rape and then strangulation. Detectives feel like she passed out from the strangulation, and Cross believed she was dead. But then when he went to pull her body out of the car and leave her for dead on the side of Maple Road, when her body hit the cold snow, it was almost like an immediate resuscitation. And he realized that she was still alive, and the brutal bludgeoning and beating ultimately ended the life of 18-year-old Tracy Lynn Hammerberg. Now, as if this case didn't have enough blows, the last and final blow to this investigation was when detectives discovered that Philip Cross had actually died of an overdose in the year 2012 at the age of 48. They were never able to formally convict him of this crime or ask him why he did this. We can only hope that he was tormented in agony until his death in 2012, since he never actually had to face Tracy's family or serve time for this murder. Well, you guys, that is the murder of Tracy Lynn Hammerberg. As always, prayers and condolences go out to the friends and family of Tracy, and may her soul rest in peace until you're all reunited once again. Thank you all so, so much for tuning into another episode of the Full Bodied Crime Podcast, and I will see you next week with another episode. And until then, have a beautiful and blessed days. Bye.